This podcast was recorded and produced in the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations. We pay respects to elders past and present. Always was, always will be, Aboriginal land. We acknowledge the First Nations people who fought and continue to fight police violence and colonial violence. This podcast is only possible because of the continued resistance and leadership of Aboriginal communities. This episode contains descriptions of police violence, racial profiling, and the death of a community member. Please take care while listening.
The death of Mikael Atikalti. So he was an Ethiopian man who was found in Maribyrnong River. He lived in Flemington, and my mum knew his mum.
So before he was found, his mum put in a missing person?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The mother was really trying to figure out what was happening to her son. Yeah. And the police station was dismissing it. They wouldn't file it in until, like, several times she went back and they didn't file it until this one person who was a new recruit who wasn't, like, I guess, indoctrinated into this culture of disregard and apathy towards black bodies and black lives, that she decided to do it. And that's when they found the body not too long after. We realized that, like, people are having conversations about our bodies and our lives and our deaths, and we weren't a part of that.
This is The People's Record, and I'm Idil Ali. Last episode, you heard about the Hail Michael case. 17 young men from Flemington who did something no one had done before in Australia. They took Victoria Police to court for racial profiling. And they won. Sort of. This episode is about what happened after, about what the official record did and didn't keep, and about what the community decided to build instead. In 2013, after 10 years, Victoria Police settled the Hail Michael case. They admitted no wrongdoing, but they made promises. A ban on racial profiling, new field contact practices, and independent inquiries. The community had fought for systemic change, and for a moment, it seemed like we might have won something real. Tamar Hopkins was the lawyer who built the case. 10 years later, she went back and looked at what the police had actually done with their promises.
In 2015, they introduced Australia's first ban on racial profiling. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they didn't set up any system to monitor that mm-hmm. ban and make sure that the police were not racially profiling. And so there was a whole lot of changes to their manual that kind of made these assertions about how the police would treat the public, and it had, you know, targeted interactions, so police shouldn't go and speak to people and ask for their name and address unless they had reasonable grounds. Mm-hmm. So all these kind of things that were set in the manual itself. But, yeah, no system to ensure that this was actually being carried out at the street level. So at the same time, they also changed their field contact practices so that now when the police were stopping a young person on the street, they would only record it if they had reasonable grounds to believe that an offence had occurred, right? So reasonable grounds to believe that an offence has occurred is the same grounds to arrest a person. So now field contact reports were only being submitted when the police had that really, really high threshold. And so that meant that the overwhelming number of field contacts that the police were doing were just not being recorded. So in fact, there was a reduction in transparency. So the data that we were able to gather for the Hail Michael report, all those field contacts that set out why the police were stopping people and also the difference in the data amounts, would no longer be available. So if we were to run this case again now, mm-hmm. we couldn't seek those field contacts mm-hmm. to get that kind of data.
The police promised to change, and the change they made was to stop recording what they were doing.
There was this incredibly ridiculous trial that the police ran, a receipting trial. Mm. We had been calling for stop and search data collection and receipting, but instead what they did was that they ran a trial in three parts of Victoria where they provided people with a receipt that had a tick box on it that they were being stopped for the purpose of welfare or a criminal issue or as a victim, but had no kind of information about why they're actually being stopped other than those really broad categories. Mm-hmm. And they weren't collecting the data on who was being stopped, mm-hmm. which was the whole purpose of the process, to track you know, what was happening. And so these trials came back with, oh, well, they weren't very effective.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't tell us anything.
So wait, just to clarify, so the trial, they weren't recording it on their end, but they were giving pieces of paper to the people. What happens if you're stopped and you want to follow it up? Does that mean that the police have no record of you being stopped?
That's right. They weren't keeping records of those stops. Okay. That's right. So they ran this trial for a few months and then they said, oh, it's not working, it's not achieving anything, and they gave up. And so that was like, that was it, you know, that was kind of the only real attempt to put in place something that could have changed operational practices within the police. And so that was really devastating to realize. And gradually, and we now have a point where the topic of racial profiling has completely gone off the police agenda.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no meetings that are talking about racial profiling or dealing with this.
The official record had done its job, not by documenting what had happened, but by making sure that there was nothing left to document. But while that official record had been quietly closed, another one was being built. Outside the courts, outside the legal system, by a group of young women who had had enough. Reem grew up in Flemington in North Melbourne. You heard her in episode 1 talking about summer nights, the world she made up downstairs, and the glass that shattered. She was also one of the founders of Imara.
It's a Swahili term. It means, from what I remember, strength and resilience. And we chose that name because we're like, oh, this really, I feel, represents who we are as young Black Africans and represents who we are as a community. And it was just like, we were like 19 and we decided on it. So we were just like, oh, like we think this bit reflects us really, really well. At that time when we formed it, we realized there weren't spaces for us as Black people. And I'm speaking just more so about Black African folks. Like, doesn't really matter what religion they are, but like that they're identified as Black Africans, especially in regards to issues concerning justice, like racial profiling, police violence, and justice issues. And it was very just simple. Like, we just need to be a part of this conversation. There were certain organizations that say they claim they represented us, but I'm like, I've never seen you in my life. Or certain groups or certain people who are like, yeah, we represent their voices and their experiences. I'm like, I don't know you guys. Like, I've never seen you in my life. And I've never, or if I have, it's just been very shifty, you know, and quite suspicious. So that's why we're just like, okay, well, we just need to be present in those discussions because people are making these really big decisions about us and our brothers and sisters are being like killed, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, that's where it came from.
Imara was set up by young Black women trying to have a voice about their bodies and lives. Reem explains why.
The narrative around racial profiling, police violence was quite skewed. And like, I think it was about changing that narrative. That was like, because police officers wouldn't even admit. Oh, like even I blatantly asked one of the assistant commissioners ages ago, and I was like, can you define what racial profiling is? Because you're not talking about it. You're like, you're not even acknowledging it, but like, I don't think you understand what it means, like genuinely. I think it was more so about that narrative. And so we existed before the BLM movement, so before Trayvon Martin was killed. And so before that, not our buildings, yes, our flats, yes, but outside that, the wider Muslim community, the wider African community didn't really want to talk about it as much or really like want to acknowledge, or even like they're just like, oh, you've been stopped by police, you must have done something wrong for that to happen, you know?
Yeah. There wasn't even a foundation of understanding.
No, 100%. There wasn't at all there was no like, the narrative was skewed towards the system and not us.
Yeah.
And so we really had to reclaim that.
So they started with almost nothing.
Initially, we were trying to figure out how to best mobilize community, mobilize young people, mobilize elders, and mobilize, our community in general. We started off with like, know your rights. you know, like stuff around like know your rights, because we're like, okay, maybe let's hold a forum. And that forum, like community forum or something like that, and that forum will have, you know, lawyers and youth workers and young people and like funny people. Like literally had a comedian there. They don't understand why we did, but we did. So random. And we're just like, cool, like let's just like create this really cool space. And it was wholesome because we were like, we don't have money to buy food. We'll make the food. So we made like injera and tsepi and like...
I love that.
Like we just were like, we'll just bring... So we got our parents to, our moms to make it and hembasha and like these are like Eritrean, Ethiopian food. We made like tea. Just like, we're so tired, but we're like 19-year-olds trying to like do things, you know? So we're talking to our friends and other folks and we're like, you know, talking to them about like what exactly they're seeing, what exactly they want, what exactly they feel is important in this sort of space we're trying to create and so forth. And like also talking to them about what their rights are. And they're like, look, if we speak up about our rights to police, that just arcs them up. It agitates them. It doesn't make us feel safe. So like, how can we de-escalate it, right? So those conversations around de-escalation happen quite early on. And we're like, yeah, like we need to have, that's where the energy should be in, is like figuring out how we can create better spaces of safetiness and so forth, and tools and resources and workshops where in which young people can de-escalate situations with police, where they can come back home whole and safe and unharmed.
And then the media found them.
There was one moment where the co-founder, she went to speak for the Age, and there was a journalist. And there was like a picture of them. If you Google Imara and Google that, like you'll see it. And it caused so much issue for us. Like it was like so controversial. It wasn't controversial what she said. It was basically like, oh, a African youth group is inciting riots in Victoria.
The Age definitely would.
And she called me up. She was like, oh my God, I have no idea. Like she's like a law student, right? She's super careful. I say shit. I will say crap. And I don't care. I'll say with my chest that they twisted her words somehow.
Yeah.
Like, it was so... Like, basically she said that if this issue isn't fixed, that the same thing that happened in the UK with the riots and so forth could happen here.
Mm.
But we need to work towards preventing those things happening. Mm.
There's a shared interest here.
100%.
And the Age said, you're the problem.
You're the problem. And so that, and then it was just like controversial. Then people started emailing us. Andrew Bolt wrote a, I was like, wow, we've topped it. Andrew Bolt wrote an article about us. I remember
you
that.
You know you're doing good work.
Slandering literally you. A year in.
Yeah.
Andrew Bolt was like threatened by us.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, so. Yeah, Andrew Bolt wrote an article to us and people like commenting and being like, these immigrants, these African immigrants need to get back to work.
You're like, I wish you could go back. Here
I wish
are.
I could if you guys didn't colonize my country.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Andrew Bolt, the most read columnist in Australia, known for decade-long campaigns against Indigenous land rights, multiculturalism, climate science, anything that makes sense, really. The kind of attention that can end organizations. They kept going, 5 years of this, building relationships, running workshops with young people, going to inquests, watching the official processes fail. And slowly, a different vision started to take shape.
But yeah, so what led to the people's hearing was like all of the culmination of all of that. And it took 5 years for it to happen, for the people's hearing to happen. And it was more about like, we were inspired by a hearing that happened in Oakland, California with the death of Oscar Grant.
Mm.
So some, like you might know the film Fruitvale Station.
Yeah.
Which obviously the famous Michael B. Jordan was in. Mm. And that was, the hearing for that kind of was kind of inspired by that death. But we saw that hearing in Oakland and we're like, this looks cool, but it just seems so... It seems so judicial, it seems so Western and kind of disconnected from how we as a community engage in these matters.
Mm.
And so we're like, what are ways in which we talk about justice. Mm. And we talk about harm and we talk about violence that still makes us feel safe, you know? And we said storytelling is a great way in which we do that. We were talking to elders in our community. We're talking to First Nations uncles and aunties as well. But it was really inspired by us being African, because as you would know, like, stories is a huge part of how we understand our faith, but also understand our culture as well, and how we understand what values are, really. And so the people's hearing really, like, came at a time where it was needed, I think, at that point. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it was needed. And we were, like, very specific about people's roles. And I know it sounds problematic, but we're like, okay, your role here is a storyteller. You're here to tell stories. This is what your role entails. And we wrote, like, it was like a play. We wrote this whole thing. And I'm like, your role is a listener. Your role here is to listen and to reflect and to hear. If you have anything to say, you can write it down and put it in these boxes.
Yeah.
That's it.
I feel like it's like, you really, when power exists in this way, like, I feel like you have to be so purposeful about redistributing power when you're holding space. You can't just be like, because I guess you're not preparing for the ideal world where people would know when it is their time to speak and when it's not, and like where to create space. What you're actually responding to and what you guys organized around is, we see what's at play here. This is the reality. Mm. And as a result, we have to be really firm about these things to carve out a space for a community that has a voice and is constantly silenced.
Yeah, 100%. You
know? Sister Zai Zander is a storyteller and organizer. She was invited to the people's hearing to support Imara to hold space for the stream of stories they were receiving.
I guess it is a formal or style of targeting of people is a way of dehumanizing. So that hearing definitely rehumanized and made people remember.
They were talking about people.
Talking about people, that they are children. People and children. And there's some pretty horrific stuff that happened. That
to
we
our
heard.
Children.
Yeah. It was historical in retrospect. But while we were in it in the moment, there was a serious issue of young men specifically having very troubling and worrying encounters with police and police investigating themselves.
Mm.
And always the outcome was that there wasn't an issue, right? And there was an issue where the parents now were starting to look at their own children as troublemakers. And these young men, these young boys were starting to feel the burden of that, carrying that shame of being looked down upon in their own communities, but also consistently harassed by the police. So I come from that segment that can live in ignorant bliss, right? And so I was learning.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time Reem came to me, right? Because, you know, Stillwaters was all about collaborating with other Black women and explain what they were trying to do with the people's hearing. It took a lot of explanations over a few times, but it made sense to me. So I was like, oh, I've got this legal background and the storytelling, I can see how these two worlds can come together here.
Mm-hmm.
And Reem started to explain to me what the people's hearing was about. You know, like, people kept throwing words like, oh yeah, town hall. It didn't even like click until we were in the town hall, the significance of being in a town hall and gathering community to speak back to power, basically, and say, this is what happened. But the intention, is that the question that you asked? The intention of it really was to bring about healing for the community. That's what Reem, Amara Advocacy, explained to me. And it was about allowing the parents to have a place to sit and bear witness, and for the young folks who were experiencing this harm to be heard and to be held.
I remember a lot of the conversations with around the people's hearing was it being centered around Black women, you know, and positioning, you know, Black women as the strongest support for the men who are experiencing that policing, you know. When they talk about that case, without the community support, those young men wouldn't have been able to take up that case and be able to go through that.
What does it look like when a community holds its own hearing? When the day came, they were in a town hall and they sat in a circle.
So rather than it being like, oh, we've got these judges who are going to judge over these sort of cases, and we've got like people who are going to stand up and talk about their case, we don't want to make people feel uncomfortable. So it was like more like, okay, this is storytelling. It's going to be a circle.
And it was a very dynamic space as well, you know. So there were videos, there were recordings. We sat in a circle. So it wasn't like a courtroom setup or anything like that. Mm. Nobody was elevated above anybody else. Our Aboriginal elders were present, mm-hmm. and really gave shape and a framework that we could then attach our stories to.
And like around 200 people attended the event over 2 days, which was like a huge turnout. We didn't expect that much. But also like leading up to it, we had run workshops with young people in Sunshine, in Footscray, like obviously inner city, and also out in southeast in Dandenong, Noble Park and so forth. And also Melton too. And we like ran workshops with them and also like just like tried to like, because young people won't attend things if they're just like, it's not worth my time. Mm. But we were like trying to contextualize why this is so important and why they should be here and why we think their stories matter. And they believed in it. And they're like, oh, I can't make it, but I can record myself talking about what happened. I was like, cool, like that'd be awesome. And so that's what they did, you know. The people seemed like, how can we make this space so safe? Who are people who can agitate that space and like disrupt that space? And we like certain groups, parties, political parties, certain like factions, we're like, okay, we know these people, how they act and how they navigate these spaces. And we don't think they serve us. And so we had to like, if any of them came, we're just like, okay, cool, you're not like, we're like, you're not meant for this space. Either you come and just listen and you're a listener and that's your role, or you have to come through us and tell us a story. Like, and it wasn't, and we could easily pick them out, you know? And they're like, no, but I'm like Arab. And I was like, okay, but is this in relation to your experiences of policing or racial profiling? And they're like, no, but I just want to talk about like, I don't know.
Why we need a vote.
Yeah, 100%.
Why do we need to have political power? Yeah, why do we need people
and
that
I was just like, that's not the point of this. That's not the point of this.
Also, what have you done?
Except shout. Yeah. And like, yeah. And I just feel that we had to sort of create the safest space where we're just like, people who knew who could speak would speak, and the people who felt they were entitled to that space weren't really entitled.
I remember, I think, because it was over 2 days. Yeah, it was over 2 days. And I think it was either the afternoon of the first day or the morning of the second day. People were just streaming in.
I just can't imagine what it's like for people to commit to 2 full days of such heavy testimonies.
Yeah.
And like the people sharing, but also everybody. I feel like it's like going to the inquests and going to like, it's these places where you know that the whole time it's going to be heavy, but instead it's not filtered through a legal system. It's raw. It's the community.
And they were coming without being, it was an open invitation.
Yeah.
Right? So some people were coming like in between work or in between this, like people wanted to be there.
Yeah.
So I think that's a testament to the work that Amara did over months, like of community building work over months, if not years, you know?
Yeah.
So that, and yeah, at that stage, it's like, oh, this isn't about us organizing. This is about community saying, yeah, we need this.
Mm.
So that was good.
It was so interesting because after the event, I remember like so many people came up to me and were like, we need another one. And I was like, you can do it.
Yeah, you said.
You can do it. I'm not doing it. They're like, no, we need another one. And I remember people from like New Zealand had come down, from Canada, from Queensland, which I was really shocked by. People had like poetry they wanted to share. And I remember this young, like 14-year-old, like South Sudanese girl was just like, can I talk? Like, she didn't even, she's like, I didn't really bring anything or write anything. We're like, yeah, it's fine, chilled, like, say whatever you want to say. And she just like was like, yeah, like I was stopped walking to the bus and I didn't understand why they did that to me. But like coming here made me realize like it's because I was black, like, you know, and like it was so simple, but so powerful and effective. So I remember one of the things we said was like, you know, we're not isolated with our experiences. It's a shared struggle. And we know that through sharing our stories, we'll understand that we're actually a lot more connected to each other. And it was, I think that was mainly one of the major purposes was like, of the people's hearing was like, oh, we just want to create, we want to like, I guess, start that process of healing because we can't resist these systems if we're not healed.
Afrofuturism has really made me start to think again of like that Nare is a circle, you know, and the people's hearing was that. It was like breathing life into somebody and saying, oh, you've been accused by this person of doing this thing. We see you. We love you. Tell us what happened.
Yeah.
That must have been scary. I'm so sorry you experienced that. Yeah. Here, let us hold you.
What doesn't get told is what it actually costs the people holding it all together.
Yeah, I was a lead organizer for that hearing. And I think you get it. I think when you're a young black girl from the flats, there's a sense of like confidence we have. And it threatens people.
Yeah.
Especially white people. And I never understood that. But I think because I was so grounded in my faith, in my deen, but also grounded in my identity as a black Muslim girl, if I felt in any way anything that was happening whilst organizing this space was not aligned with community and not aligned with what I believed Allah would want out of this, then I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to be a part of it, or I didn't want to like, I would stand against it. And that rubbed some people the wrong way. There was a moment where people's hearing was gaining momentum, it was gaining like attraction and like a lot of like eyes as well. And that was I didn't really care about that. I just wanted to create a safe space for community. I wanted community to be healing. I didn't really care about the glitz and glamour of it. I didn't really care about creating this like massive event so that white people can feel like, oh my God, this is great. We're going to be hearing two sob stories from black people and Pacifica and First Nations folks, and it's cool, it's great, right? That wasn't the intention. I didn't care about that. There was a certain person who was a former politician who wanted to be a part of the event, was invited by a member from the committee. We had an organizing committee. And this member invited this person without checking in with us and checking with me really too and the rest of them. And so I was like, I don't know who this person is. I was like young when this person was a politician. And I'm like, I don't know who this person is. I really don't know much about them. So I met with them and I was like, oh, he's boisterous. Like, and like just very, very politician, very like.
Shapeshifter.
Yeah.
Not really a personality.
Slightly chauvinistic. Just a voice. And I was like, I don't really like rate this person. But I was like, I don't know much about him. Everything online is like stuff that looks good. So I was like, but I don't know much about him. And they said, if you invite him, then we won't want to be a part of it. And I was like, why? Well, who is? And then so they said, during his reign, Indigenous deaths in custody were still on the rise. Operation Molto existed, which was like a task force instigated by police that sought to target young black men in Carlton, Flemington, North Melbourne flats. People still being stopped in search. There were so many issues that had existed under his reign. And I was like, oh, yeah, I wouldn't want that.
Yeah.
I don't want that in my space. Like, makes sense. It was like black and white for me. But this person was so like adamant that they wanted him. And I'm like, I don't want I don't think we should. And we've spoken to the committee, the rest of the committee, they've said no. And we'll lose a huge chunk of our community, maybe most of it, maybe like 90% of it, if we bring him in. So I'm so sorry, I'm not really interested. They kind of left it and then called me up whilst I was on my way to an exam and started hurling abuse at me. Anyways, I was like, okay, I hung up. And then I remember like literally verbally abused me for like 30 minutes straight. And I was just like, look, I understand you're deeply like upset and committed to this person. And I know this looks bad for you because you've invited this person. I was trying to like.
You said a little bit of compassion. And
yeah, let me be diplomatic.
Yeah, let me see.
Let me just try and be diplomatic. Yeah. And it was embarrassing because some of my friends who are part of the committee were seeing this unfold. And they were just like, Reem, you handle it so well. I was literally like inside twisting.
Yeah.
I was both angry and upset and I was like furious, but also scared because this grown ass man was shouting at me. I was like trying to calm him down. I'm like, I'm not your mom.
Yeah.
I'm like a child, you know?
This is what organizing looks like from the inside. Not the 200 people in the room, but the 30-minute phone call on the way to the exam.
We were really young when we were organizing. I think that's something that we all, when we came together recently, had a chat. And maybe that distinction wasn't as clear then. And I think just generally in the world of these sort of, call it a project, that at that time, people were still, you figure things out in the process of doing it, you know? And I think when it comes to liberation, what I'm seeing now, and like with other storytellers and their curatorial practice, we didn't think of the healing for ourselves as the facilitators as well. So it was a very tough, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot to carry.
Yeah.
It was a lot for all of us to carry, and we were young. So I think models for storytelling for liberation make space for the organizers to be held as well in some way.
Tamar had seen this pattern from the Hail Michael case too. The way the system capitalized on exactly this, the exhaustion, the burnout, the weight of protecting the community.
I mean, I think the police really can capitalize on this because they are massively funded.
Yeah. You know,
$1 billion a year operation. They drag these things out for years.
Mm-hmm.
They also, I mean, people are genuinely terrified of them. And so what we found really interestingly during the whole case was how, in fact, some of the older members of the community were very discouraging of young people from staying engaged with the case, were terrified, were saying, don't take on the police. You don't have a chance. Don't do it. And in fact, the police were forming alliances with some of the older members of the community.
I was 22, 23, and I was like, I'm tired.
Mm.
I'm so exhausted by this. And I just felt like the system had done its job in trying to sort of like snuff all the light out of me, if that makes sense, and all the idealism I had in me.
After the hearing, there were the stories, hundreds. But what do you do with all of them?
Just neither here nor there now that
I don't. I think it served a purpose.
Yeah.
We could, like, my intention, like, if I had energy and money, if I had a rich white man. That was like
rolling us.
Literally. I would have been like,
we're all our own retreat.
I know, but I was like, I really wanted to, my dream for it. I didn't want to submit it, but I really wanted to do like an online interactive sort of thing where it includes those stories, pictures, images. It's kind of like accessible. And also you could still submit stories. Yeah. That's what I imagined as a 21-year-old, I hoped.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was like, oh, I want it to be like this online thing where like, it's like maybe sort of like a book or like an online book that is accessible and like, it's got like, and you can easily like search through things and it's got different stories. It has different, like videos because people were submitting things through like different mechanisms.
Mm.
It has like maybe little comics or whatever and like, music because people were like singing it at the event as well and poetry and like, but it won't end there. People can still continue to submit stories. That's why I was dreaming for that. And then I was like, I'm too tired. I was too exhausted.
But the stories exist somewhere, in boxes, on hard drives, in people's memories. Not lost, but not assembled. The record Reem imagined was never built. But Sister Zaya had a way of thinking about what that means.
I've been reading this. The title of the book is actually really troubling, but you can tell that it was published in the 60s originally. And so this man had no control over all of that, you know. Then I think it's like stories from a Zulu witch doctor. I think what's a witch doctor? Witch doctors don't exist. Like they're medicine people, right? They're healers. And he's talking, there's a particular chapter where he's talking about the drum and how every African society has its drum. And when that drum is played, it evokes something in the person to whom that drum belongs, that drum pattern, that drum sound. Even the most cowardly of people, when they hear their drum being played, will turn into the most ferocious of warriors. And then he also says, if you want to defeat a people and to make an entire society crumble, when you conquer them, you take away their drums. So there for me, like the drum is an analogy or a metaphor for the story and the archive of the story. The stories are in us, right? Like they're in our bodies physically. We've experienced them. I think decolonial psychologists talk about this a lot now, like intergenerational trauma and all that. So the story, or even intergenerational wisdom, right? So the stories are always within us. But when we don't know how to tap into them, because we don't have the archive, we don't have the document, or we're not documenting it ourselves, then we can very easily become confused. So you look at anthropology, that's us being documented by other people. And then we go to university and we learn that this is what your people were like. You go, okay. Or you walk into a lot of museums and you look and say, oh, okay, the ancient tribal primitive people. You go, oh, heavy language, okay. Really? So those kind of things, like when other people document you and when you allow them to tell you who you are, you know, you can very easily lose yourself.
And what's the strength of us documenting those stories for ourselves is that we're warriors, that we become ferocious, that we're able to
resist. We stand in our truth.
Yeah.
We stand in your truth. And I think truth is always going to be, yeah, we know this, we're in Victoria, we're in the Kulin Nations, right? Yeah. Truth is always going to be the first step towards anything.
We now have a point where the topic of racial profiling has completely gone off the police agenda.
What's your feeling in terms of like what's changed?
I think the police have become more smarter. They've adapted, but I don't think it's gotten better. And I think that has shown in the overrepresentation of our bodies in the justice system, in prisons, the fact that more bodies are being killed. I think the level of surveillance is a lot more insidious and also very like undercover as well, like very like, just very insidious, kind of like they know where our weak spots are. I think before they were just like, they didn't really, but
before
now
it's just brute force.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas now
it's a bit more like
strategy.
Yeah. They're being more strategic about it because they realize that we do have a backbone, you know? But I also think in saying that our community, especially young people, are a lot more like, I feel like 100%. I mean, you say this to me, but like if I existed in this generation, it would be different. Like, I think the level of support I would have gotten would have been very vastly different, and I would have been in a different stage at my life, you know? But I think the thing that I find about young people in now is that they're also just as smart and also have adapted and also have shifted, you know? So I think there's still hope in our youth.
Reem had a dream, an online space where stories could live, where people could keep contributing, where the record stayed open. This podcast has a name, The People's Record. That's not an accident. Ahmed chose a pseudonym in episode one because his name is Dada. The 14-year-old girl at the hearing stood up with nothing prepared. Mekiele's mother went back to the police station again and again. Daniel, at 14 years old, had a police van drive up onto his basketball court, the only backyard he had. Reem organized a two-day hearing for 200 people with no money and no sleep, and then carried the exhaustion of it for years after. These are the things that don't make it onto the official record. We're putting them here.
With hard lockdown.
Yeah, with hard lockdown. Like, that was quite... Like, we were, like, under siege. My dad, so funny, and he's just like, why are you locking us up? Like, I don't feel safe here now that you've, like, basically said that we're contaminated with, like, COVID or, and we're infected with COVID and so forth. Like, I want to be able to breathe fresh air. Like, I don't, like, I've got an immunocompromised, blah, blah, blah. And he's just, they're like, yeah, no, we understand. And I'm like, he's like, you know what I feel like? I feel like we're with West Bank and Flemington's Gaza.
Next time on The People's Record, 9 towers, over 500 police officers, a hard lockdown, and a community that's been here before. This is The People's Record, and I'm Miguel Ali.
This podcast was produced by Ila Diaz and Lucy Griffin for the Center Against Racial Profiling. Hosted by Idu Ali, edited and mixed by Andrew Futan and McEwen. Music by Pip Norman, and design by Peter Morgan. The People's Records thanks the Community Broadcast Fund, 3CR, and Humdinger Studios for their generous support.